Hi everyone, my name is Mike DeBliss. I am presenting today for Esquire CLE. I'm honored to be speaking today on the topic of anatomy of a civil tax controversy. A little bit about me, I am a trial lawyer. My start was in the public defender's office here in New Jersey, and my interest in tax peaked after I started working on a tax fraud case. And that led me to go back to school to pursue my master's in tax law. And today I handle a variety of tax issues, helping expats living abroad to get into compliance with their tax obligations, as well as handling civil tax issues from audits to criminal tax cases. So when it comes to civil tax controversies, there is a certain rhythm to the audit process, and it can be a scary beat. It's much easier to go through this with a good attorney or a good CPA who's well-versed in handling audits. I've reduced these to steps. By no means is it as clear and black and white as these steps might indicate, but it gives us a frame or a lens in which to look at a civil tax controversy, and it also gives us a helpful tool for issue spotting. So in step one, the IRS conducts a tax audit. A tax audit is an examination of the taxpayer's income and expenses to ensure that the taxpayer correctly reported his or her tax liability. Now, all types of tax returns are subject to audit, including income, business, estate, and gift tax returns. In step two, it's what I call the 30-day letter. An examination results in three possible determinations. The first option or the first possibility is that there is an increase to the taxpayer's liability. The second result is that there's a decrease to a taxpayer's liability. And the third is that there's no change to the taxpayer's liability. Upon completion of the exam, let's suppose that the revenue agent determines that a deficiency exists. Well, let's define what a deficiency means. It is defined as the taxpayer's correct liability as determined by the IRS less the amount reported by the taxpayer on their return. Assuming there's a deficiency, the agent prepares what's called a revenue agent report. It's sometimes known by the acronym RAR. Included with the RAR is a cover letter and a settlement agreement. A taxpayer who disagrees with the revenue agent's findings may request a conference with the IRS Appeals Division. And if they do decide to do that, they have to request this within 30 days. It's for this reason that the cover letter is known as a 30-day letter. A taxpayer who receives a 30-day letter faces a strategic decision between A, requesting a conference with the IRS Appeals Division, or B, simply doing nothing. Now we move on to step three. In step three, if a taxpayer requests an appeals conference with the IRS Appeals, but the parties don't come to an agreement, or if the taxpayer simply ignores the 30-day letter, the IRS sends the taxpayer a notice of deficiency. The notice of deficiency is also known as a 90-day letter. It provides a taxpayer with two options. First, to pay the asserted deficiency and follow the refund procedures, or two, petition the tax court to contest the claimed deficiency within 90 days of the date that the notice was mailed. The mailing of the notice of deficiency begins a period during which the IRS is prohibited from assessing any tax. Now we move on to step four. In step four, the taxpayer petitions the tax court. Let's assume that the taxpayer timely files his tax court petition. If he does, then he can challenge the deficiency claim by the IRS as well as any overpayment claimed by the taxpayer. And as I indicated before, the IRS is prohibited from assessing tax during this period. In fact, the prohibition against the IRS assessing tax goes all the way until the tax court's decision is final. Now we get into some nuts and bolts and some practical applications of what goes on here. The first question that you might ask is, who represents the IRS in tax court? Well, it's contrary to popular belief, the IRS is not represented by a revenue agent in tax court. Instead, the IRS is represented by an attorney from IRS Chief Counsel's office. These attorneys, as you can imagine, have backgrounds in tax. And as because they're attorneys, they have backgrounds in litigating. So that makes them a very formidable adversary in this arena. As a general rule of thumb, these individuals are more likely to make some concessions to reach an out-of-court settlement than the revenue agents are. And there's a couple of reasons why. You're probably ticking them off in your head right now as I speak. One of the reasons, as you can imagine, is that the IRS chief counsel have large caseloads. And, when they go to court, they're not just going to court with one or two cases that they're nursing. They have dozens of cases. The other thing to be aware of is that when it comes to tax court, it is the equivalent of a road show, like the antique road show. They come to different locations and they stay there for a certain period of time before they move on to another location. So there's a predetermined period of time during which the cases are being evaluated, and that time span can sometimes impact settlements and negotiations and willingness of the IRS chief counsel to reach a quick resolution. However, there's protocol involved, and we'll get into that. So these are some of the reasons. The first, IRS chief counsel are less emotionally invested in the case than the original auditor. The original auditor may have poured hours and hours and burned the midnight oil, doing their due diligence and finding where there were deficiencies on the return. Meanwhile, the IRS chief counsel gets the case and they basically look it over. They are the modern day equivalent of the county prosecutor who gets a case after the detectives have spent weeks or months working it and following leads and going into black holes or winding up in places where they just took a complete spin and went off the beaten path. So for those reasons, the IRS chief counsel are usually less emotionally invested than the original auditor. Second, the IRS chief counsel's dockets are extremely full, as we just discussed, and every case they resolve is one less case they have to try. Third, IRS chief counsel is quite familiar with the hazards and costs of litigation, and they weigh these factors into their negotiations. So as I mentioned earlier, these attorneys are well-versed in the tax code. Many of them have a background in accounting and have masters in tax law, and they have experience having litigated cases in the past, and so they are infinitely familiar with the hazards and costs of litigation, and those factors factor into their decision-making abilities. When there is no agreed resolution, the matter proceeds to a bench trial. There is not a jury trial in tax court. It's a bench trial. The judge is the decision maker. Only a very small number of cases make it this far because it's essentially the bottom of a funnel. If the taxpayer loses, well, he does have due process. He or she may appeal the resulting decision to the Court of Appeals for the circuit in which he or she resided at the time he filed the petition. That is very critical, as that's going to give rise to another issue later on in this presentation. Step 5, if the taxpayer does not respond to a notice of deficiency by petitioning the tax court in the time allotted, remember the 90 days, or by paying the tax outright, the IRS makes what's called an assessment. An assessment is the doomsday scenario, because once it's made, that deficiency becomes a debt of the taxpayer. The IRS, of course, must give notice and demand for payment to the taxpayer as soon as practical and within 60 days of making an assessment. Now, what happens if the taxpayer refuses or neglects to pay the tax after notice and demand is made? Well, in that case, the amount of the tax liability becomes a lien on all of the taxpayer's real and personal property until it is paid. So as you can see, this is very serious business. Once an assessment is made, and once the IRS has given notice and demand, we are dealing with a situation where a lien is inevitable. And as I said, once if the taxpayer refuses or neglects to pay the tax after notice and demand is made, the amount of that liability becomes a lien on the taxpayer's real and personal property until it is paid. I want to just take a slight digression into eggshell audits. These are very, very sensitive audits where the taxpayer may have reason to believe that there may be something awry and that they might have done something that goes a little bit beyond just an oversight or negligence, and perhaps falls onto the side of the spectrum of willfulness. Now, the IRS often audits taxpayers who, unbeknownst to the IRS at the start of the exam, have major criminal problems. The practitioner assisting such a taxpayer will have done his homework and ascertained that there's a problem and the scope of the problem. The strategy at that point becomes one of damage control. As you might already know, a traditional source of CI referrals, CI is the Criminal Investigation Division of the IRS, a traditional source of their referrals is, in fact, the civil audit. So here are some tips when it comes to eggshell audits. It's important to recognize that it's too late for a voluntary disclosure. And what I mean by a voluntary disclosure is that the IRS has a special program in place called the Voluntary Disclosure Program. And basically, it gives a taxpayer who knows that they have done something, let's say, nefarious, and that it is, and that on the scale of, you know, benign, non-willful behavior, all the way to the scale of willfulness, the needle tips more towards the side of the scale that is willful. In those cases, before an eggshell audit's been conducted and before the IRS has caught whiff of this issue, the taxpayer can submit what's called a voluntary disclosure. And the voluntary disclosure program, it's available presently for domestic cases. It's no longer available in the offshore version that was an enormous tool many years ago. But the taxpayer, if they choose to do so, you know, can pay some penalties and make a willing voluntary disclosure, so long as the IRS hasn't already discovered the tax non-compliance. And by paying some penalties, the taxpayer can avert disaster. They can insulate themselves from a referral to the Criminal Investigation Division by paying the penalties and by coming out ahead of this by making a knowing and voluntary disclosure. Now, in some cases, disclosure to the agent may be the best option. For example, when the practitioner can obtain a reasonable level of assurance that the civil agent will not refer the matter to CI, so that disclosure of the fraud to the agent will not result in a referral for criminal investigation. As you can imagine, this is a very, very thin line, and the tax practitioner has to be very careful with what they disclose, because obviously they don't want to arm the examiner with ammunition that can be used against their client. The practitioner's job at all times is to represent the client zealously and protect their interests. The last thing the practitioner wants to do is, is to be the one responsible for his or her demise. So it's a situation that's very tenuous, but one that might be available if the tax practitioner knows the examiner and has confidence in and a reasonable level of assurance that what they're disclosing to the agent won't refer in the matter being referred to CI. Disclosure to the agent may still be the best option even if reasonable assurances cannot be obtained. If the fraudulent item is so obvious that it's not a matter of if, but when the agent will uncover it, the best strategy might be to disclose the error in the hope that by correcting the item, the disclosure will gut the willfulness element to such an extent that CI may not be interested in taking the case. Again, this is a big risk, but you know, as I said here, I'm talking about a situation where the fraudulent item is so glaringly obvious it is flashing like a neon sign out of a window in a bar. In that case, you know, as I said, it's not a matter of if the examiner is going to discover it, but when. So in that case, the best strategy may be to disclose the error in the hope that by getting out ahead of it, that disclosure will be a good faith one, and one that might gut the willfulness element. And the other thing to recognize is that, you know, if you have a fraudulent item that is just ringing the proverbial bell, Liberty Bell, you know, and it's an examination, and an examination is in progress, you might have an argument if you get out ahead of it and you disclose it, even when the examination is in full course at trial. If the matter ever goes to a criminal trial, I could foresee an argument being made by defense counsel that the CPA or the tax attorney who was handling the audit knowingly and voluntarily disclosed the fraudulent item before the examiner called the taxpayer out on it. That might have the potential of gutting the willfulness element of tax evasion, which is a very high mens rea or mental element that the government must prove in order to make their case in chief. Let's assume that the civil examination proceeds without making a full disclosure. Of course, and it goes without saying that the practitioner has to limit the contact between the agent and the taxpayer. A good practice is also to audit the agent. As a practitioner handling an eggshell audit, you want to know what the agent knows in real time, if you can. And what I mean here is that it's incumbent upon the practitioner to track the investigation and keep current on what the agent knows. IRS civil agents must notify the taxpayer before contacting third parties, and they must keep a record of the third parties contacted during the civil phase of the investigation. There's also Section 7609. In Section 7609, the IRS is required to notify the taxpayer of summonses issued to third parties. The notice requirement is void in criminal investigations, however. Now, if a witness voluntarily provides information without the need for a third-party summons, the record may be collecting dust in the agent's file, generally until it's requested by the defense. However, if you establish a good relationship with potential witnesses during a civil exam, and asking these witnesses to call you if the IRS contacts them, that'll put you in the know a lot sooner than receipt of records via a FOIA request. So there's a lot of ways to be in the know and to ensure that you are, you are tracking the investigation to keep current on what the agent knows. Now, if the agent issues a third-party summons and neither you or the taxpayer receive notice, that means that the summons probably was probably issued incident to a criminal investigation where there's no requirement. Second, issued with notice sent to the incorrect address. Or third, issued in violation of the notice requirement. Okay, so I'm going to say that again. If the agent issued a third-party summons, but neither you or the taxpayer received notice, that summons probably was issued incident to a criminal investigation where there is no requirement that the taxpayer receive notice. Second, it was issued with notice sent to an incorrect address. Or third, issued in violation of the notice requirement. Now, if you notice, a little while ago, I mentioned an example of a witness who voluntarily provided information without the need for a third-party summons. Those present very challenging cases for the practitioner, because when a witness voluntarily provides information, part and parcel of that is that the IRS doesn't need to issue a summons. And because the IRS doesn't need to issue a summons, there is no notification to the taxpayer of the statement or the information that was voluntarily provided by the witness. And in that case, that's why I mentioned that it's good to have or establish a good relationship with potential witnesses during a civil exam. That should be on the list of priorities for the practitioner, establishing a good relationship with potential witnesses so that if they do get a call from the IRS to provide information and if they willingly cooperate, it would be nice to get a call from that same witness letting you know that they in fact cooperated and provided X, Y, and Z. And like I said, the witness who voluntarily provides information doesn't receive a third-party summons. So, you know, aside from, you know, keeping these witnesses, establishing a good relationship with those witnesses, there would be no other way for the taxpayer to know of this information that the witness provided. Okay. Now, if the civil audit turns quiet, that's usually code red for a problem. It doesn't always mean that, but if you're the practitioner and you know that this is precarious audit, and it turns quiet after a buzz of activity, there's a good reason that it might have gone south. So it's always good in those cases to contact the agent or their supervisor immediately to find out what's going on without tipping off the agent about there being anything nefarious. A FOIA should also be considered if it becomes clear that the case will be referred to CI. Now, after the agent has completed the audit, it can take one of two directions. First, the agent may not perceive there to be any fraud, and they might just simply close the civil examination with proposed adjustments or a no change letter. Second, the agent may determine that the case has sufficient criminal potential to be referred to CI. Although the Internal Revenue Manual requires that the agent refer the case to CI whenever there's a firm indication of fraud, in practice, agents are taught to consult with their group managers or fraud technical advisors to review the fraud potential in an exam. While a referral can occur anytime during the exam, it normally happens near the end. Okay, so that is what the Internal Revenue Manual mandates, that there be a firm indication of fraud in order for the agent to make a referral. But in practice, what usually happens is that the agent has a group manager, and the agents will consult with their group manager or their fraud technical advisors to review the fraud potential before automatically making a referral to CI. And you know, while referrals can occur anytime during the examination process, they normally happen near the end. So what type of cases are generally referred for prosecution? Let's back up and shed some light on the criminal tax enforcement system. Just like the typical law enforcement system, it has limited resources, but in opposition to the general law enforcement system, the criminal tax enforcement system has even less limited resources, if there is such a thing. Coordination and prioritizing are essential to get the maximum bang for the enforcement buck. The Department of Justice tax is vested with the responsibility of trying these tax cases in the federal courts of the United States. It also has authority to approve all tax-related indictments. DOJ's criminal enforcement section applies its investigative and prosecutorial resources strategically so as to support the goal, the overarching goal of our tax system, which is preserving the integrity of this nation's self-assessment tax system through vigorous enforcement of the internal revenue laws. So that's a broad and sweeping statement. And as you can see, the DOJ's criminal enforcement section is vested with a hefty goal here. And yet they have very scarce resources. So one of the objectives one of the things that they do to strategically vet out the cases they're going to take is to zero in on those cases where A, they have a high likelihood of conviction, and B, where they are likely to obtain the maximum amount of publicity from such a conviction. So if your mind is already ahead of mine, you're probably thinking that Hollywood actors are prime targets because of the salacious lifestyle they live and how many followers they have on their Twitter accounts and on their Instagram, and how they, when they're the target of a tax investigation, they the media immediately picks up on it, and virtually every magazine and newspaper has them on the cover. Well, that will heighten the deterrent effect among would-be tax cheats. And it's for that reason and that reason alone that the government oftentimes targets high net worth people and those in Hollywood. And then they'll go after, of course, attorneys and professionals to make examples of them, CPAs, accountants, enrolled agents, entrepreneurs, big business CEOs. Those types of cases are going to maximize the bang for the buck and heighten the deterrent effect among would-be tax cheats. So with scarce resources, they have to be very strategic. And again, they do so by prosecuting relatively few cases every year. At last count, I saw that it was ranging from 25 or 3,000 up to maybe 4,000, 4,500. And again, they focus on the strongest cases in which conviction is high, and they zero in on targets with a high profile, like celebrities in Hollywood, so that the conviction will receive the maximum amount of publicity, encourage compliance, and heighten the deterrent effect among would-be tax cheats. DOJ and the IRS accept the fact that there is a substantiality requirement to tax evasion. In general, the IRS will recommend criminal prosecution under Section 7201, which is a tax evasion statute, only if the average yearly additional tax for criminal purposes is at least $2,500 in specific items cases with uncomplicated facts, or it's $10,000 for the prosecution period in indirect method cases. Or
Esquire CLE's first verification code is RAG, R-A-G, all lowercase, RAG. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is RAG, R-A-G, all lowercase, RAG. Please take a moment and write this down.
Cases with complicated facts. So it's important to distinguish two types of cases. There are specific items cases with uncomplicated facts. Then there are indirect method cases or cases with complicated facts where in indirect method cases, it's not as simple as pointing to the tax return and comparing the tax return to the gross receipts of the company and saying that here you can see, jury, there is a discrepancy between the gross receipts on the one hand and what was reported on the tax return on the other. Those are indirect method cases because they call for extrapolating information to substantiate the evasion, the tax evasion. Whereas in specific items cases with uncomplicated facts, you can take the tax return on the one hand, the gross receipts on the other, and simply flash them up on a monitor and point them out on the screen and tell and have the jury just do a stare and compare and see the discrepancy. So it's $2,500 in additional tax for criminal tax purposes when it's a specific items case, but it's $10,000 for the prosecution period when it comes to indirect method cases or cases with complicated facts. Upon receipt of the referral from CI, the criminal enforcement section determines whether the case is within its prosecution enforcement priority. It has the discretion to decline the IRS's recommendation and return the matter to the IRS either for further investigation or with instructions to close it out from a criminal investigation. However, if CES approves the case, it will usually forward it to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the district where venue for criminal prosecution lies. Let's talk about Section 7525A1 of the Internal Revenue Code. That covers the common law protections of confidentiality that apply to communications between a taxpayer and a federally authorized tax practitioner. Here I want to reference the case of U.S. versus Arthur Young and Company. That was the old Anderson Consulting. In that case, the Supreme Court of the United States held that accountants' work papers are not protected from an IRS summons under the work product doctrine. This means that information and documents that are already in the possession of a tax preparer are not privileged and thus can be obtained by the IRS. Now let's talk about the attorney-client privilege in the tax realm. The attorney-client privilege in the tax realm protects both legal advice and tax advice. However, where the advice is tax advice, the scope of the privilege is limited. What I mean by limited is two things. First, there's no privilege for communications relating to investment or business advice or services. And second, the preparation of tax returns is generally not considered to be legal advice within the scope of the privilege. Notwithstanding all of that, the attorney-client privilege in the tax realm is significantly stronger than the federally authorized tax practitioner client privilege. So when it comes to privileges in the tax arena, once again, the attorney-client privilege is it offers more strength than the tax practitioner-client privilege. But once again, when the advice rendered by the attorney to the client is tax advice, the scope is significantly limited, and that's in two ways. First, there's no privilege for communications relating to investment or business advice or services. And second, the preparation of tax returns is generally not considered to be legal advice within the scope of the privilege. A quick and dirty rule is that any legal advice given by a tax attorney that ultimately ends up on the client's tax return is treated as given as part of return preparation and is not covered by the privilege. Here, there's a case called U.S. versus KPMG. It was a Supreme Court case, and there the court held that a tax opinion regarding the tax consequences of certain investment portfolio transactions was not subject to the attorney-client privilege because the opinion was prepared in conjunction with preparation of a return. And as a result, the evidence was discoverable. However, there's a Seventh Circuit case called U.S. versus Frederick, and that case takes a more nuanced approach to the privilege. It states that, quote, "It cannot be assumed that everything transmitted to the tax attorney by the taxpayer was intended to assist him in his tax preparation of a tax return and thus might be conveyed to the IRS. There, the court recognized that information furnished to a tax attorney could just as easily have been offered by the client for the purpose of receiving legal advice. So there is some precedent in the Seventh Circuit that might allow for the tax attorney to argue that the information that, or the advice that was rendered was not necessarily intended to assist in tax preparation of a return. Instead, the information furnished by the attorney to the client could have or was being offered for purposes of the client receiving legal advice. So it would be important. It would be imperative to distinguish between the advice being rendered for purposes of tax preparation versus to assist the client in tax preparation versus the advice being rendered for the purpose of the client receiving legal advice. Now I'd like to jump into the Covell accountant. What is a Covell accountant? Well, first of all, it got its name after a case, and it's spelled K as in kite, O-V-E-L. Basically, a Covell accountant is an accountant that is brought under the cloak of the attorney-client privilege, which, as we discussed, is a stronger privilege than the tax practitioner-client privilege. So that sums up why this Covell accountant arrangement was even born. It was born out of the idea that the accountant-client privilege is flimsy and not as tight or as strong as the attorney-client privilege. So lawmakers began to think of ways where it might be possible to bring a accountant under the cloak of the attorney-client privilege. Why? Well, for obvious reasons. The accountants actually prepare the returns, and they're on the front lines. So oftentimes when the IRS is conducting their investigations, the first source for obtaining information that will be helpful to the government in building their case is by going to the source, going to the accountants and obtaining the information that obtaining the returns and obtaining their work product so they can build the case against the client, against the defendant. And so for those reasons, the defense bar became very vocal and outspoken about a privilege that would bring the accountant privilege up to the level or the magnitude of the attorney-client privilege. The Covell accountant, and by the way, you know, nobody assumes that a tax professional is going to just arbitrarily turn over anything to the IRS by an agent making a phone call. These requests always come in the form of subpoenas or summonses. And that's what starts the dance or the dispute, so to speak. And that's how the genesis of the Covell accountant was born, through legions of cases that bore this out. So the Covell accountant should be engaged as early in the process as possible in order to derive the maximum benefit from the accountant's work. If the budget permits, three professionals should be engaged during an eggshell audit. This is my personal recommendation. The first professional is the tax attorney. The second professional is the forensic accountant. And the third is an independent accountant. So let me just back up for a second. I know that we're buzzing around a little bit, but we are talking about an eggshell audit. And remember that in an eggshell audit, there's a fraudulent item or items that the client and the tax professional fear are going to be discovered by the agent during the exam. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to find a way to protect and insulate the client as much as possible from, God forbid, a referral to CI. So we're trying to find the path of least resistance and do the best we can for our client. So three professionals are encouraged to be engaged. Once again, the tax attorney, second, the forensic accountant, and third, the independent accountant. The Covell accountant would assist the tax attorney in gathering all potentially relevant information, and the tax attorney would determine what portion of the information to disclose to the independent return preparer. In that way, while the independent preparer's knowledge is discoverable by the IRS, the information disclosed to the Covell accountant would remain privileged under the attorney-client privilege. So what we're doing is we're bifurcating roles. We're keeping the roles of the original preparer and the Covell accountant distinct. And by doing so, that best preserves the attorney-client privilege. Why? Well, using the original preparer as the Covell accountant would be a recipe for disaster, even though it saves money. Why? Well, the original preparer as the Covell accountant would run the risk that he would not be able to distinguish between what he learned prior to the time the privilege attached and what he learned after the privilege attached. All right, so what we have here is we have to know what's going on our timeline. In dealing with an original preparer, we have pre-Covell time and we have post-Covell time. Pre-Covell time is when the original preparer maybe happier times before an examination came to fruition, where the original preparer is preparing the taxpayer's returns. If you remember what we just discussed, the original preparer or the preparer client privilege is not as firm and ironclad a privilege as the attorney client privilege. So in pre-Covell times, before the preparer is brought underneath the cloak of the Covell accountant, is brought under the cloak of the Covell accountant, there is merely a flimsy tax preparer client privilege in place. So the information that the original preparer relies upon to prepare the client's returns is liable to be discoverable and obtainable by the government when the government sends the preparer a summons or a subpoena. Post-Covell, after the tax attorney comes on board and after the tax attorney hires a new accountant to begin sifting through everything, that new accountant's work product is not as readily discoverable as the original preparer's work product was, for obvious reasons. The new accountant is now brought under the cloak of the Covell, or the attorney-client privilege. And by being brought underneath the cloak of the attorney-client privilege, less information is discoverable by the government because it's, once again, more of an ironclad privilege and protection and cloak. So if we use the original preparer as our Covell accountant, we are running the risk of a disaster, because how is the original preparer going to be able, number one, to distinguish between what he learned prior to the time the privilege attached and what he learned after the time the privilege attached? Okay, and once again, only after the time the privilege attached, the Covell or attorney-client cloak covers, only after the privilege attaches will that information be covered by the attorney-client privilege. Moreover, the initial preparer already possesses enough information to provide a roadmap to the fraud because of the work product and because of the work that he had done for that client before the eggshell audit was triggered or started. Okay, so once again, when you're dealing with an original preparer, you're dealing with somebody who has a relationship with the client over the course of time and whose work product and whose returns that he did on behalf of that client are the very scope of the eggshell audit. So that information is readily discoverable by the government because of the weak and flimsy tax practitioner client privilege, whereas the information that the work product information that the Covell accountant generates is now brought under the cloak of the attorney client privilege. So it's not a good idea to bifurcate and to save money, have the initial preparer also be the Covell accountant, because as I said, he or she's not going to be able to distinguish between what was generated pre-Covell engagement versus what he did post-Covell engagement. And that in itself is going to be a disaster for what information gets more heightened protection versus what information gets less heightened protection for from summonses and subpoenas. And once again, the initial preparer is, you know, potentially the agent for very damning information that the government would love to use against the taxpayer. So how do we create an airtight Covell agreement? First, the attorney should engage the Covell accountant and not the client. It's also recommended that the lawyer pay or at least approve the accountant's invoices. Second, a new accountant rather than the client's existing accountant should be engaged. The client, of course, will want his existing accountant to be used for a myriad of reasons. However, this could wreak havoc later on. As we already discussed, it might be difficult for the original accountant to distinguish between what he knows outside the Covell engagement versus what he knows within the scope of the Covell engagement. Remember that only what is within the scope of the Covell engagement is protected by the attorney-client privilege. Moreover, using the existing accountant requires that additional steps be taken to ensure that the info garnered within the scope of the Covell agreement is clearly separate from the information learned before the Covell agreement was executed. This can become tedious and arduous. For these reasons, I recommend starting fresh and hiring an independent accountant from the get-go. IRS appeals. We're going to take a small divergence into IRS appeals and talk about the role of appeals, hazards of litigation, what does appeals consider, what issues can the taxpayer raise, an overview of the appeals process, role of the appeals team manager, examining what if an agreement is reached versus what if an agreement is not reached, and looking at the independence of appeals and ex parte, and then non-docketed versus docketed cases. So there are legal requirements for appeals, and they're found in a variety of sources. The first being, of course, the Internal Revenue Code. The second being Treasury regulations. The third being revenue rulings. The third being revenue procedures. And the third being court decisions that consider tax disputes. So what must appeals consider? First, they ask the question, did compliance follow all required legal and administrative procedures? So let me just back up again. We're in the area of IRS appeals. IRS appeals is basically a mediation function of the IRS. They are a department that will take a look at a dispute that the taxpayer has over maybe a deficiency or over something else. And they are considered to be ex parte, even though they are an office within the IRS, they're still considered to be ex parte. And they are charged with bringing a neutral and independent perspective to the dispute and making a decision. Now, it's of course very, you know, very difficult to think that they are going to make an independent decision when they are tainted, so to speak, because they are, you know, a department within the IRS. They're paid by the IRS, by the government. Nonetheless, it's become more and more the IRS appeals has become a growing presence in the agency and has been called upon to resolve disputes in more cases than they have in the past. As a matter of fact, in some cases, there is an absolute requirement that the case makes its journey through IRS appeals before the taxpayer can just unilaterally petition the tax court to take the case. So how is appeals run, or what are the legal requirements underpinning appeals? You have the Internal Revenue Code, Treasury regulations, revenue rulings, revenue procedures, and court decisions that consider tax disputes. An appeals employee will first start out by asking the age-old question, did compliance follow all required legal and administrative procedures? They'll consider the issues raised by the taxpayer. For example, whether the notice of federal tax lien was appropriate and whether there are appropriate collections actions. They then will balance the need for efficient tax collection with the taxpayer's concerns about the intrusiveness of the collection action. What makes the appeals function distinct from examination? Well, appeals is uniquely positioned to recommend a resolution that is somewhere between fully sustaining or fully conceding the examiner's proposals based on the uncertainty of the outcome of the case, based on the uncertainty of the outcome, if I should say the case was considered by a court of law. So that's basically the tagline. It's whether it's to consider the examiner's it's to make a recommendation that lies somewhere on the scale between fully sustaining or fully conceding the examiner's proposals based on uncertainty of the outcome if the case was considered by a court of law. So here we should compare what examination does to what appeals has been granted the authority to do. Fair and impartial is a theme, and a mandate of appeals. And by fair and impartial, that reflects mutual concessions. It's based on relative strength of positions, and it takes into consideration the uncertainty that comes from litigation. In evaluating hazards of litigation, appeals considers both factual hazards and legal hazards. So for factual hazards, this is when there is uncertainty as to the court's findings of facts. Factual hazards exist in the tax realm when there is either incomplete evidence or conflicting evidence. This evidence could either be records or testimony of witnesses. For example, let's say the taxpayer may be claiming actual mileage as a business expense. The taxpayer presents documentary evidence that establishes odometer reading at the beginning and end of the year. These numbers determine total mileage driven throughout the year. Yet during the examination process, the taxpayer told the examiner that he lost the business mileage log, so the evidence needed to support business mileage deduction was incomplete. Conflicting evidence comes into play when the testimony of witnesses does not corroborate the same story. And so we have a situation here where we have documentary evidence establishing the odometer reading at the very beginning and then at the very end of the year. And of course, these numbers determine the total mileage that's driven throughout the year. Yet, as I said, during the examination process, the taxpayer tells the examiner that he lost the business mileage log, so the evidence needed to support the business mileage deduction was incomplete. So it may be difficult, it will be difficult for the taxpayer to claim actual mileage as a business expense unless the IRS relies upon the documentary evidence of the odometer reading at the beginning and at the end of the year. Now for legal hazards. Legal hazards are basically uncertainty as to how the court would apply or interpret the law. Legal hazards exist when there is a conflicting case law, absence of legal precedent, conflict between the IRS's position on an issue and court decisions, ambiguity in the applicable statute or regulation, or conflicting law. So once again, we're gaining insight into what IRS appeals takes into consideration when they are reviewing these disputes and how they have to have some foresight and think about the legal hazards, the factual hazards that would come up in litigation. And this is why, this is the rubric, so to speak, that they follow when they make concessions and when they either enforce the examiner's position or they make concessions. Now, there are three main issues that appeals considers. We talked about one of them already, and I'll restate that. It's whether compliance followed all required legal and administrative procedures. All right, so this is basically, the three main issues that they consider. Once again, did compliance follow all required legal and administrative procedures? By that I mean, was a notice of intent to levy issued in accordance with the law? Did the IRS notify the taxpayer as required that notice of a lien was going to be filed? If they didn't, well, there are serious consequences for that. And did the IRS issue the notice of a hearing timely? The second main issue is the appeals employee will consider all issues raised by the taxpayer with the exception of moral, religious, or constitutional objections. Those usually fall within the category of tax protesters. Third, the appeals employee will balance the need for efficient tax collection with the taxpayer's legitimate concerns about the intrusiveness of the proposed collection action. What issues can the taxpayer raise? Well, any relevant issue relating to the unpaid tax or the proposed levy, including appropriate spousal defenses. Appeals will only consider challenges to liability if the taxpayer has not received a notice of deficiency or had other or otherwise had an earlier opportunity to dispute the liability before appeals. That is very, very important, all right? Because most of the time, the taxpayer is challenging the underlying liability. So once again, the groundwork here for IRS to consider challenges to the liability, to the underlying liability, is one, that the taxpayer has not received a notice of deficiency, and that usually is very rare. It does happen, but that's usually rare. Or second, that the taxpayer had an earlier opportunity to dispute the liability prior to the case being diverted to appeals. All right, so this is like a one bite at the apple type thing. Appeals will be loath to consider a challenge to the underlying liability if the taxpayer already had an earlier opportunity to challenge the underlying liability. For example, if the taxpayer received a letter 1153 informing him of a proposed trust fund recovery penalty and did not appeal the proposal at that time, appeals does not have the authority to consider whether the taxpayer is liable for the penalty during the CDP, the collection due process hearing. What are some other issues that the taxpayer can raise? We named one already. A second is challenges to the appropriateness of the collection actions. And the third are offers of collection alternatives. So Internal Revenue Code Section 6330 requires appeals to evaluate collection alternatives offered by the taxpayer, such as posting of bond, installment agreements, offers in compromise, and substitution of other assets. A basic requirement before appeals will consider alternatives is that the taxpayer has filed all required tax returns prior to the hearing. So it's incumbent upon the taxpayer that all of their returns have been timely filed up to the hearing. Note well that while appeals is considering the case, interest continues to add up on any unpaid balance that your client may owe. So let's do a quick overview of the appeals process. These are sources of cases to appeals. Appeals receives cases from a few different divisions, from LMSB, from SBSE. These are just acronyms, or, you know, they stand for different departments of the IRS, WNI, TEGE. Generally, disputed tax cases come from the compliance function within each of these divisions, or what's called the examination or collection function. Within each function, the field offices or campus offices work the entire spectrum of cases relating to that spectrum. Therefore, appeals receives cases from both field and campus sites. How to request an appeal depends on the source of the dispute. Since appeals is separate and independent from compliance, the taxpayer must first request an appeal to the office that proposed the original determination or the specific collection action. Appeals will then receive a complete administrative case file that includes your client's position and the government's position. Second, in tax disputes generated as a result of an examination of your client's tax return, taxpayers must submit a written request to the examination office that reviewed their return. In cases where the dispute is less than $25,000, no formal protest is required. Third, for collection issues, it depends on the type of collection dispute. So once again here, there is a requirement on the taxpayer to take some voluntary action in order for an appeal, for IRS appeals to review the case and to come in and weigh in. Now, there's been a trend over the last several years where cases have been diverted to IRS appeals without the need of the taxpayer to take a voluntary step in that direction. But for the most part, the appeals gets a case by way of a request. And once again, the taxpayer must request an appeal to the office that proposed the original determination or specific collection action. Second, in tax disputes generated as a result of an exam of your client's tax return, the taxpayer must submit a written request to the examination office that reviewed their return. Once again, no formal protest is required if the dispute is less than $25,000. And third, for collection issues, it depends on the type of collection dispute. There's commitments and expectations. The commitments are as follows. That appeals has to your client: explaining your appeal rights and the appeals process, listening to the client's concerns, being courteous and professional, being responsive, and allowing the taxpayer a reasonable amount of time to respond to any requests for information, and of course, being fair and impartial. The expectations are as follows: listen to appeals explanation of your appeal rights and the appeals process, give appeals a statement as to how you understand the facts and the law, listing all issues with which you disagree and why. Give appeals any additional information or documentation that will help your case. Tell appeals when and how you think the case should be resolved. And finally, let appeals know the best time to contact you. So some of them are, you know, very general and basic common sense. There are conferencing options. Appeals consideration of a tax dispute is designed to be informal. It's an informal administrative process. There are conferencing options. There's correspondence that takes place in the mail. There's telephone. There's face-to-face. However, not as common in our post-COVID times. What is the role of the appeals team manager? Well, the appeals team manager approves the final outcome of a case. The appeals employee will make a recommendation to the appeals team manager, including whether or not an agreement has been reached. The appeals team manager will then review the file and approve the case if the settlement is appropriate, or return it to the appeals officer if additional work or consideration is needed. What if an agreement is reached? If an agreement is reached and the client doesn't owe anything or a refund is due, the tax preparer doesn't have to do a thing. If there's a refund, the campus will send it to the client. If the taxpayer owes some amount, they have payment options. The taxpayer can pay a few different ways. First, they can pay the full amount due. Second, if the taxpayer can't pay the full amount all at once, he or she may qualify for a payment plan. For example, if the total amount owed is under $25,000, the taxpayer qualifies for a 60-month payment plan. Third, if the taxpayer doubts that he can afford to pay the full amount, even under a payment plan, and he has filed all of the required tax returns, he can consider submitting an offer in compromise. If successful, the taxpayer may be able to pay a lesser amount in full satisfaction of the tax liability than what he actually owes. If the taxpayer does not reach an agreement with appeals, the appeals officer will inform the taxpayer as to any further options he or she may have. What if an agreement is not reached with appeals? Well, if the taxpayer requests an appeals conference, but the parties don't come to an agreement, the IRS will send the taxpayer a notice of deficiency. The notice of deficiency, as you may recall, is also known as a 90-day letter. Now, a notice of deficiency provides a taxpayer with two options. The first option is to pay the asserted deficiency and follow the refund procedures, or petition the tax court to contest the claim deficiency within 90 days of the date the notice was mailed. Now, the reason why we have the reason why these timeframes become relevant is because if the taxpayer does not petition the tax court within 90 days of the date the notice of deficiency was mailed, then they are barred from petitioning the tax court and having the tax court preside over.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is MAP, M-A-P, all lowercase, MAP. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is MAP, M-A-P, all lowercase, MAP. Please take a moment and write this down.
The issue. So essentially, the taxpayer is barred to contest the disputed deficiency if they run afoul of the 90-day period. So that's why, as a tax professional, you need to be scrupulous when it comes to knowing when these timelines expire. The mailing of the notice of deficiency begins a period during which the IRS is prohibited from assessing tax. So if the taxpayer petitions the tax court, the prohibited period continues until the tax court's decision is final. So what that means in, if you extrapolate and you take the 90-day period that we just discussed, the IRS is prohibited from assessing tax for 90 days from the date the notice of deficiency is mailed. And to the extent that the taxpayer petitions the tax court within the 90-day period, the prohibited period during which the IRS cannot assess tax continues while the case is docketed in tax court until the case is resolved by way of a trial or decision or a agreement is reached between the taxpayer and the chief counsel's office. But all of that to say that the decision in tax court is final. Up until that point, the IRS will not be able to assess tax. Only after the tax court's decision is final will the IRS be able to assess. Independence of appeals and ex parte. The mission of appeals is to resolve tax controversies without litigation on a basis that is fair and impartial to both the government and the taxpayer. How can appeals demonstrate it is fair and impartial to both parties when the appeals employees are workers, are employees for the IRS? Well, the integrity of appeals depends on its ability to remain fair and impartial to both parties. And, you know, it's an oxymoron because at the end of the day, these are people who work for an agency and who are employees for the IRS. So they are, they're tainted, so to speak. Their paychecks come from the IRS, and the taxpayers know this. So they are not gullible. They don't see this as completely independent and fair. But the mission, of course, does mandate that IRS appeals be fair and impartial. Now, Congress recognized the need for appeals independence when it passed the Restructuring and Reform Act of 98. Section 1001 requires the commissioner or required the commissioner to develop a plan to reorganize the IRS. Section A4 devised a plan to ensure an independent appeals function within the IRS. It's a plan that prohibited ex parte communications between appeals employees and other IRS employees to the extent that such communications appear to compromise the independence of the appeals employees. Revenue Procedure 2000-43 was the result of this legislation. It describes what ex parte communications are and what is prohibited versus what is allowed. So, how do these ex parte rules affect how appeals communicates with compliance? Well, first, there can be no discussions about substantive case issues between appeals and compliance without inviting the taxpayer to participate. All right, so that's pretty much a black and white rule where, once again, there can be no discussions between appeals and compliance about substantive issues in the case. without inviting the taxpayer to participate. So to the extent the taxpayer is invited to participate, that obviates the prohibition and allows the appeals officer and compliance to speak. You know, but once again, the taxpayer is a party to it. Second, if the taxpayer provides new information to appeals, appeals asks the examiner for their opinion in writing and shares their comments with the taxpayer. All right, so if there's new information provided by the taxpayer to appeals, appeals then can ask the examiner for their opinion in writing and share their comments with the taxpayer. When there is need for further clarification from the examiner, the appeals officer may contact the taxpayer and even invite the taxpayer to participate in a conference call or meeting with them about that new info. Third, this law includes discussions with IRS chief counsel attorneys about non-docketed cases. So if appeals needs advice about an issue, it must be given by an IRS chief counsel attorney who did not provide advice to the compliance employee. All right, so once again, what we have here is a situation where if the appeals officer needs advice about an issue, they cannot just randomly and arbitrarily contact the IRS chief counsel's attorney who already provided advice to that compliance employee. The advice must be sought by a different IRS chief counsel attorney who did not provide advice to that compliance employee. Fourth, if an appeals employee believes it is necessary to talk to a previous IRS chief counsel attorney regarding an issue, the taxpayer or their representative must be given an opportunity to participate in that discussion. There are some exceptions to the ex parte rule. The administrative file itself, developed by compliance and forwarded to appeals, does not violate the ex parte rules. So as you can imagine, you know, appeals is neutered or rendered useless if they don't have an administrative file to go by. They won't know what dispute they are overseeing without the file, without the administrative file. So for that reason, compliance forwards their file to appeals. And that file does not, that transfer of the file does not violate the ex parte rules. Since the administrative file contains a proposed determination and the taxpayer's protest, it sets forth the baseline boundaries of the dispute between the taxpayer and the IRS and forms the basis for appeals to assume jurisdiction. So for that reason, it's an exception to the ex parte rule. There's also another exception where contact with compliance relates to administrative, ministerial, or procedural matters. So for example, if communication is necessary to confirm whether a particular document is reviewed, that ex parte communication is permitted. Third, where the communication is needed to understand an individual's handwriting. Fourth, if the taxpayer's representative has been offered the opportunity to participate in a discussion between appeals and compliance, but unnecessarily delays responding to that opportunity, the ex parte rules no longer apply. Delay, of course, has a definition, and that and it's defined as beyond a reasonable amount of time. So what is reasonable? You need to go and look at the cases that were spawned by this rule. Now, do the ex parte provisions change the appeals policy regarding raising new issues? No. Appeals still has the right to raise new issues, but it doesn't do so often. New issues are never raised casually or haphazardly by an appeals employee. They are never raised for bargaining purposes. Now, to raise a new issue, it must be substantial and it must have a potential impact on tax liability. And that impact must be material. By material, we're talking about having real importance and great consequences. Now I want to take a divergence into non-docketed versus docketed cases. What are non-docketed cases? Well, they are these are appeals made on a protest basis in response to a 30-day letter, or what's colloquially or collectively referred to as a revenue agent report. This means that no court has jurisdiction over the taxpayer's dispute. Docketed cases are those where if the taxpayer petitions a tax court without having had a conference with the appeals division, the case is considered to be in docketed status. If appropriate, IRS chief counsel may forward the case to appeals for the purpose of reaching a negotiated settlement prior to the case being heard by tax court. However, if appeals and the taxpayer are unable to reach a negotiated settlement, then a court of law will ultimately decide the taxpayer's dispute. So a docketed means that the taxpayer, for whatever reason, may have wanted to leapfrog over appeals and go directly to the U.S. tax court. And in that case, they would have filed a petition to the U.S. tax court. That type of case is considered to be in docketed status. However, as I just mentioned, there are times when IRS chief counsel feels that it may still be appropriate for the case to be reviewed by appeals before it is conferenced in tax court for the purpose of maybe reaching a negotiated settlement. However, if appeals and the taxpayer are unable to reach a negotiated settlement, then a court of law, it will decide the taxpayer's dispute because the matter, of course, is already docketed there. What are the types of non-docketed cases? The first type of case is one where the examination function has issued a 30-day letter accompanied by an examiner's report outlining the proposed adjustments resulting in an increase to the taxpayer's tax liability. In that case, the taxpayer has 30 days in which to agree to the proposed adjustments or to request an appeal to the proposed adjustments. Second situation is when there are denied claims for refund or abatement of unpaid tax. Now, tax disputes from taxpayers who requested an audit reconsideration. These are situations where a taxpayer may request for an audit reconsideration. And it's granted, yet the examination does not reduce the tax liability in full or in part. The taxpayer can have the dispute considered by appeals. Note well that the taxpayer has the right to appeal an adverse U.S. tax court decision to the Circuit Court of Appeals for the circuit within which the taxpayer resided at the time he filed the petition. So there is due process and there is a right to appeal an adverse U.S. tax court decision, and that will go to the Circuit Court of Appeals. But you need to know what Circuit Court of Appeals to file that appeal in. And once again, it would be the Circuit Court of Appeals where the taxpayer lived at the time he filed his U.S. tax court petition. I'm going to cover briefly the transfer and conference procedure changes in appeals. Appeals has implemented changes to its case transfer and conference procedures. Previously, in cases where a face-to-face conference was requested, appeals allowed automatic transfer from the campus service center to field offices. Upon reviewing this procedure, the IRS discovered that taxpayers often requested a case transfer where a campus employee could have resolved the case. In addition, there were added costs for shipping as well as a delay in case resolution. Another consideration was that many of these cases transferred were ultimately resolved by a telephone conference. The change is that appeals will not transfer cases based only upon the taxpayer's request and will consider a number of factors before an in-person conference is granted. The hearing officer makes the initial determination to grant an in-person conference, and the appeals team manager will make the final decision. The Internal Revenue Manual has been updated to reflect these changes. And now we're going to end on IRS collection methods. The IRS can collect amounts owed in several ways. There are The main ways here are, number one, through an installment agreement. An installment agreement is one where the taxpayer is allowed to pay the amount due over a period of time. The second method of collection is an offer in compromise. If accepted, it's got to be accepted by both parties, the IRS and the taxpayer. If accepted, it would allow the taxpayer to pay a lesser amount in full satisfaction for settling the case. The third collection method is a levy action. A levy action is a legal seizure of property, such as cash, wages, or bank accounts, to satisfy a tax debt. Now, there's the filing a notice of federal tax lien. Basically, a lien gives the government a claim to property as security or payment for a tax debt. A notice of federal tax lien is a written notification, and it notifies the public that the government does have such a claim. During appeals consideration, what happens with the collection action? Well, levy action is suspended during the period of time that appeals considers the taxpayer's timely request for a collection due process hearing relating to a notice of intent to levy. In equivalent hearing cases, collection can move forward on a levy if the IRS determines that the collection of tax is in jeopardy. So once again, if there's a levy action, is suspended during any period of time that appeals is considering a taxpayer's timely request for a collection due process hearing that relates to that notice of intent to levy. So this brings us to the end of the lecture. If you have any questions, feel free to give me a holler. I've provided my email and contact information in the slides. It's been a pleasure to present this case, present this topic to you. As you can see, it's a very vast topic that goes off in many divergent directions. But what I wanted to try to do was provide you with a framework and give you some exposure to a bunch of different areas, and at the same time go into a little bit of nuance so that it would help you when it comes to issue spotting certain things in your own practice.